Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
どこいるんだ。
本当？見えないでしょ。どこにいるのかな。見えない。
あ、こんな
ところ。
What's good, internet? Welcome to the Waypoint 101 for Clay Games, Mark of the Ninja. I'm your host, Austin Walker, and joining me on this roundtable, this mysterious, hidden, secretive, stealthy roundtable, the elusive Danielle Riendo.
Hi, Mark. I'm Ninja.
The clandestine Rob Zachney.
I did not do it. I did not put the mark.
The furtive Patrick Klepek.
It's Clay Entertainment, not Clay Games.
Thanks. You know, we're off to a great start today.
We're doing good.
They do more than just games. You know, they do entertainment.
It's beautiful animation.
It is beautiful
great,
animation. It's
great
true.
At animating
it's true.
Things.
We've gathered here today to pay our respects to either, I would say right now, we're about to spoil this game. We're going to talk full spoilers, Mark of the Ninja, the 2012 Clay Entertainment joint. We're here to pay our respects either to Mark the Ninja, who mm-hmm. took his own life at the end of Mark of the Ninja, mm-hmm. or to the corrupt leader of the clan, the Hisomu clan, who we killed with our inky blade. Pay our respects. You know,
yes.
whichever
Respect
choice you
all.
Made at the end. We picked this game partially because we wanted to do something that was not just like another shooter. We've done a lot of shooter only point 101s. Also because I think Mark of the Ninja was one of those games that popped up during the beginning of the kind of 2010s independent games, quote unquote, renaissance, that brought in a lot of people to the idea of playing a game by a small team. And one that I think brought people to a stealth genre. Or to the stealth genre, a genre that I think put a lot of people out because of its inability to be clear about information. And going back into Mark of the Ninja, for me, the thing that I was curious about was, would its big triumph, its ideas of clarity, readable, not just UI, but game world, and kind of interesting mechanics that all went around clear information, still work? And for me, it largely did. I'm curious for the rest of you on the cast. Did you play this game back then? And what was your impression then? And then briefly, what was your impression this time through? Danielle, let's start with you.
Sure. So I actually never played it, which is weird because
oh, wow.
this is
yeah.
so in my wheelhouse.
It really is.
But weirdly, so I didn't really play a ton of stealth games before Dishonored. Mm. Dishonored was my sort of entry into the genre. And this came out 6 months, maybe. I know it was the same year, but I'm pretty sure this one was actually predating Dishonored by a little
One
tiny
month.
Bit. 1 month.
Yeah,
oh
both
my
fall
god!
Fall 2012 games.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So, and I actually didn't play Dishonored until a little bit after Dishonored came out. So, whatever. But I didn't actually have a ton of experience with this game. I sort of knew Chris Dahlin through the sort of Boston indie game world mm-hmm. a little bit. Chris Dahlin was the narrative designer on this game,
gotcha.
So I was familiar with this game. I was familiar with sort of what it looked like, what it played like. But I'd never actually played it until last week. And I really enjoyed it. My sort of high-level take was, this is a really fun, interesting stealth game. The story didn't necessarily land for me, which I'm sure is yeah. something we'll get into. But gameplay-wise, I really enjoyed the stealth, and I really did enjoy that sort of readability. Of course, I'm coming into this right after Into the Breach, which is, like, for me, the high bar of perfect information to the player for making decisions and so on and so forth. So that's, like, a pretty... I think I do not have a low bar for that sort of thing. So I was impressed by how well this played in that regard. I also should say I didn't finish it. I put 4 or 5 hours into it. I feel like I got a good chunk out of it and I enjoyed it, but I did not finish it. So that's my high level.
Rob, your lips are pursed. You have your finger. You're
well,
I'm curious.
It's been a challenging arc. So I did play it when it came out. So years and years ago, Nels Anderson, the lead designer on this game, led a really great panel at, I think, like the very first PAX East, when they did it at like the Heinz Convention Center, about like indie stealth games. Mm-hmm. And this game came up, and so did Monaco.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's yours is mine, mm-hmm. Which had a very different take on stealth, but it was a really good talk about like what it was to make a modern stealth game. And at the time, nobody really knew that there was actually an immersive sim stealth game renaissance around the corner, right? So to a degree, this game, I think, was made in the middle of this desert for this kind of game design, right? Like, nobody could get the Looking Glass band back together, but at this point, right, you had a new generation of designers sort of hearkening to that era. And Mark of the Ninja looked like the most promising project there, and certainly to my tastes, it was the most successful stealth platformer. It's interesting to me because I got it when it came out, and I played through like a few levels, and I fell off of it, I think. I fell off of it around the mid-game. And what surprised me here coming back to it is I basically followed that same arc with the difference that I pushed through the point where I started to fall off it. And what's interesting is I was really happy I did, because I think this game starts off worse than it finishes. This is a game that I think builds and crescendos. It layers in new elements, new mechanics. The puzzle difficulty increases, and you get more comfortable with a pretty elaborate control scheme. And so I had this weird arc where probably my first 3-4 hours playing this, I was kind of having this feeling of, I should not have suggested this. This was perhaps a poor decision. I am not sure this game holds up. I am very bad at it. It is frustrating. I am not having a great deal of fun. And then in like the last week, it really started to click with me. And I flipped completely over into, damn, this is the Clay Entertainment that I really wish we had, right? Like, man, Mark and the Ninja and Invisible Ink just all the way down. What a flourishing of stealth creativity in this period. And so I came all the way back around to being really impressed and delighted by a lot of this game, and particularly the game it sort of unfurls into being once you have mastered the controls and unlocked a lot of your tools.
Yeah, that is definitely a big part of it. And we'll talk about where that turn happens, I think, too. Patrick, how about you? I know you were a big proponent of this back in the day.
Oh, yeah, I was a Mark of the Ninja stand back at the Giant Bomb. This game was a huge favorite of mine when it came out. As someone that largely, like, I played the thief games, I played a lot of stealth games, but I always find myself so frustrated, you know, very much a quick save, quick load sort of mentality, because, you know, this is something I think that came up in Dia's review of Shadow of the Tomb Raider, which is also a game that has a stealth action dynamic, is that, you know, the stealth is only as good as the action component that's connected to it. And so what Mark of the Ninja suggests is actually, like, what if there's no action component? Like, there's only the stealth component. And it also quickly identifies, like, the main pain point of a lot of stealth games. Like, let's use Metal Gear Solid as like, I think a lot of people, I mean, Thief is something that works for all of us, but I think Metal Gear works for, like, a larger group of people. Metal Gear in the stealth portion is really enjoyable until you're caught, and then, and this is, you know, certainly pre 5. I think 5 made that a little bit easier, also having the big open world mitigated some of this. But it was a lot of, like, sneaking around. Now you're caught. Now go hide under something and wait for the clock in the corner to go down.
Right.
The troops go back to their patterns, and then you can resume whatever it is that you were attempting to do. And so you're punished into a waiting period for possibly minutes at a time because of a small error. And so Mark of the Ninja, what I... yes, the readability, yes, the fact that everything's very clear helps you navigate that space. But also one of the things that I really enjoyed was that when you're caught and you get shot at, you just fucking die. Like, yes, you can get away. It is possible. You can, like, if it's one-on-one, you can try and knife a dude and get away with, like, a really clumsy kill. But, like, by and large, the game functions in a binary sense of you are in stealth or you are not, and then you die, and then you try again. And so even in the case where you are, like, briefly spotted, it's 10 seconds, 5 seconds. They don't chase you across the map. It's like a very contained – it's a game that identifies what people like about stealth and then all the things that genre was not identifying when the stealth part breaks down, and then thinking through, well, how do we make the stealth part more enjoyable, last longer, and allow people to do more of what they wanted to do? Because so many stealth games are, okay, I have in my head, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z.
Yep.
And then it doesn't pan out. You get caught. And then it's frustrating, and either shoot everyone in the room, or you have to hide around a corner for a couple of minutes.
Or you go, I guess the thing I was supposed to do was this other thing. This is the one solution. I'll do my one solution.
Yeah, and this is a game that sort of, I think, like very much its design ethos is identifying pain points in the stealth genre and then trying to come up with solutions. And I think you can see how everything the game does is derived from that like larger ethos of like, what are these? What is the pain points in the genre, and then how do we solve them? And I think even now... it's like holds up remarkably well. It's, yeah, it starts so blah 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 blah. But I, you know, once you kind of get over that hump, it is still, I think, a really tremendous accomplishment that while it has its own pay points that are true of any game that you're coming to years and years later, I think absent that, I think this is a game that you can go back to, even if you it's not a nostalgia fueled appreciation. I think there are things about it that remain steadfast and interesting and make it a fun game to play, where by the time I was in hour 4 or 5 here, I wasn't just playing it because like, oh, I gotta make sure I got my talking points for what we're gonna do in this conversation. I was like, oh, this game is just really good, and it holds up remarkably well, especially once you start getting the tools and you have more options as a player.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny you talk about the, like, quick failure. Like, okay, hey, you're spotted, you're dead. Or, for me, you're spotted, I hit pause, I hit restart checkpoint. Because there's very, very generous checkpointing in this game.
Yep, that part is great.
And there's a point at which it starts to feel like Tony Hawk's Pro Ninja, where it's just like, yeah, this is a bad run. This is a bad run. Stop, pause, restart, quick load. Like, the load is very quick. And, like, that is not a small thing in games like this. In any, you know, you compare it to something like Super Meat Boy or like really difficult platformers where like, no, I want to be able to just get back in the saddle and try again. And this game really encourages that. And I also think, and maybe for me, this is one of the complaints I had going back into it, especially up top when I was trying to be a completionist, is like Tony Hawk Pro Skater, you care about your score. And I will say that especially at the top when you don't have a lot of tools unlocked, there are behaviors that I found myself performing because I wanted the points so that I could unlock the point, the like XP or whatever I needed to get gear and get upgrades more quickly. And I was doing those for the reward more than because they were good behaviors. So for instance,
I'm gonna go ahead and drag a guy across the map so I can put him into a great. That system does not hold up particularly well. I think it would have been better served by like moment to moment rewards. But to get yourself over the top to get that third.
Yes.
Yeah. So, like, the structure of the game is that you are, you have these, like, sub-goals, like, hey, take out 20 lights, put 5 guards into a dumpster. But on top of that, you're given points based on execution of various kills. So, if it's a stealth kill, plus it's a stealth kill where you do the short quick time event, which is a button press and an arrow right or left, you get more points. And then if you take that body and then successfully hide it, it's even more points. But often, I would say maybe 70% of the time, the game has a very convenient location for you to dump the body because it's keeping in mind, like, oh, it's a score-based game, so we want to make sure that we're keeping the level design is keeping that in mind at all times. But then there's that 30% where, like, no, this portion has 3 enemies, and maybe the game was suggesting you could just move on, but it's the score thing, so you want to try a solution to whatever the AI puzzle is. Find a way to exploit it so you can kind of just make it work. And then dragging them all, like throwing them over things to try and get them at extra 150 points. And that part is not great. And that's one of those,
it's
annoying and it takes me out of it.
I want to do that because it's the right maneuver, not because it's the way to get most points. In Hitman, I do it because if someone finds his body, I'm fucked.
Yep.
And most of the time, because the levels are fairly linear, no one's going to stumble onto these bodies unless I'm in the middle of clearing out an area. Whereas, like, the thing that I end up doing is, like, not only do I drag people, like, into the grates or wherever, I will straight up make sure someone walks under me so I get the 200, I've bypassed the guard point. Like, little things that are encouraged. And I'm not – this isn't – again, I really did enjoy my time with this. And especially the thing that ended up happening was I started to get the tools that made dealing with enemies more exciting and more fun. And at that point, I was focused on coming up with interesting solutions. And so I was getting the points I needed anyway. I wasn't as worried. I would absolutely start just leaving corpses, just lying out in the sewer. Like, you know what? You're just fucking
here. Or skipping some areas. I found myself at certain points looking at sections where, all right, there are 3 enemies here. This is clearly like a high level like encounter to clear out, but there is very obviously like a grate that goes under them, mm-hmm. and right. I can just dodge this entirely. Right. And what once you learn after a couple hours is, look, you're going to be able to get all, most, if you want to clear the whole tree, then yeah, okay, you're going to have to engage in all this sort of like chicanery in order to maximize your points. But generally, you can kind of just stick to the main path and like do most of the stuff, and you're going to get most of the upgrades. And I found once I started embracing that, I liked the score system to a point, but then it hit us. There were certain yeah. things where I had to walk myself back, and I actually wish the game was finding ways to walk me back instead of pushing me into like really annoying habits that had me playing the game in a not maximally fun way. It was a maximally efficient way,
yeah.
and I don't. Those are not necessarily the same thing.
I think this is kind of the crucial part about the arc I went on with this game. Now that, like, hearing, like, as we talk about this, what also happened in the last week? I realized I needed to finish this fucking game.
Yeah.
Like, prior to that, I had been really score chasing, right? Like, especially because those early levels, at the end of each level, there are the three objectives that you can complete for, like, special bonus points. And they're pretty achievable in those early levels. In the early levels, it is surprisingly, it feels within my grasp to do the ghost run in those levels
yeah.
and get all those good achievements. And so then I sort of got it in my head that I wanted to have these like perfect, maximally efficient runs. And I did start getting to the point where I was ruining the game for myself. If somebody even spotted me, I was like, well, that run sucks. I'm just going to stand here and let this guard walk up to me and shoot me to death. What happened in the last week is that I started basically just like, you know, play it as it lays, right? Oh, those guards spotted me. Up to the ceiling, zip across. Like, yeah, this guy's shooting at me. Oh, went straight through the laser fencing. That's fine. There's a turret now shooting. I think a rocket just killed something. It's fine. And like eventually get across the room into a place and I sort of regather myself. And it turned out that is actually a fun way to play too. It is fun. The version of Mark and the Ninja where you're just kind of a mediocre ninja. Like, you have a big skill set, but a lot of it is about escapability.
Right.
And just creating chaos to, like, get out of trouble. That is also a fun way to play this game. Maybe the most fun way to play this game. But everything in the game, when it comes to the scoring screen, incentivizes this really meticulous perfectionism that can make this game feel punishing and a little bit frustrating, especially because it's like you're controlling a really sticky Metroidvania character.
Yeah.
And it can be really tough to make what feel like they should be pretty basic sorts of jumps over enemies to not be seen. And your character will glom onto things you do not want them glomming onto just because that is the nature of the way your character moves through the level and relates to surfaces.
Totally. Danielle.
Yeah, it's very interesting because I normally play stealth games way too much and way too perfectly.
Right.
Not perfectly. To be clear, I went through all of Dishonored 2, never killing anyone, but I got seen a bunch of times. Like, I don't actually care if they see me. As long as I can knock them out, put them in the recovery position, and make a pyramid of bodies that are just sleeping and cuddling each other, I'm having a good time. But it didn't seem like there were as many options or as good options for, like, a non-lethal playthrough the way I mean, yes. Okay. If you went all stealth, I guess the way I'm talking about it, like, not all stealth, but all, like, humane.
Right.
Exactly. There's not a lot of knocking them out.
There is eventually, so there in the remaster,
yeah.
and maybe even the special edition that came out years ago, there's a side option, sure. or there's a side story that you can do that is about the tattoo artist, and if you complete that, then you unlock a different costume that gives you a non-lethal option. Okay. So you just got to do that.
I got to go through that way.
And then it's all chops, and I think it only knocks people out, and they can be woken back up
okay.
or, like, unstaggered or whatever.
Which is fine.
Yeah, totally. But you'll be moved on by then because you're a ninja.
Cool ninja. But I played this, and maybe it's just because it's so different. Maybe because it was a 2D game as opposed to a 3D game, which I'm very used to that sort of first-person perspective in a stealth game. Because, again, I came to this genre late.
Right.
I play a lot of Dishonored. I play a bunch of Hitman. Obviously not, you know, necessarily the same point of view there, but a lot of that sort of paradigm of, like, okay, it's totally fine to knock people out and just kind of put them in a way.
Right.
I just played this, like, chaotic mess of the ninja, which is, like, I enjoyed and had fun with, and I was like, wow, this is different enough for me to just be a disaster all the way through these levels, and I'm still enjoying it.
Awesome.
Mess of the Ninja is my favorite episode of Tidying Up.
Yeah, perfect. Great. Before I have to cut out, actually, in about 15 minutes, 10 minutes, I wanted to read a comment from the forum and touch on some of the story stuff. This comes in from Vehemently, who says, so before getting into the meat of the stealth in this game, I do think it's worth talking about two questionable elements about Mark of the Ninja, the portrayal of Japanese culture and the ending. Keep in mind, it's been a couple of years since I played it. Mark of the Ninja is about ninjas, so it's going to dabble with Japanese culture. I don't think this is necessarily always problematic, but I do feel a little uneasy about some of the themes in this game. I mean, the game starts off by talking about seppuku, and you collect a bunch of ancient scrolls with death poems on them. I recollect a lot of talk of honor and clans and et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think this was doomed from the get-go, and honestly, some of it works, but some of it just feels fetishistic. I'm also concerned about the implications of the quote-unquote insanity caused by the ink. Regarding the ending, it's revealed that Aura, who is your kind of ninja partner through the game, your not a mentor, but she's kind of your guide. She's the voice in your head as you're exploring the levels and giving you objectives and stuff. It's revealed that Aura is actually a hallucination caused by the ink. My concern here is the trope of madness and insanity. I think it would have been fine if Aura was shown as the ink incarnate, or that the madness is the ink of a corrupting force. But from my recollection, it's treated as a case of psychosis. I think this becomes even worse when what is often considered the good ending is where the player character chooses to go through with the seppuku and stop that madness, which has some bad connotations. I definitely read that ending as the bad ending, but that's probably just because fuck the corporate ninja overlord, right, who ends up being the bad guy, or who ends up being revealed to have been kind of pulling the strings all along. I think the word uneasiness feels right here, which is like, it's a game about ninjas. Like, it's going to be a game in which there are ninjas and there are ninja clans and there's going to be some talk of loyalty and fealty. But there is still a degree to which, and I think the things I did really well, I love the idea of this modern ninja clan that is going up against mercenary groups. There is something that played for me with that. Especially because, like, the ninja clan then makes the decision, we are going to become a mercenary group. We are going to take this technology. We are not tied to the past in this way. But there was something that was just, it was sticky in a way that I think I went and looked, there weren't many conversations about this at the time. And I think that suggests a pretty big change in the last 7 years of games criticism, because today I think we would have a lot of conversation about the degree to which a Western studio, a Vancouver-based studio telling a story about Japanese ninjas, like, to what degree is that appropriative? How do you do that in a way that is successful versus a way that kind of is reductive and really is just repeating a bunch of old tropes? And I'm just curious for y'all, like, did you have that uneasiness? Is there anything that worked for you that you were surprised that it worked, or vice versa?
Well, I think aesthetically, it does a lot of work to make it go down a little bit easier. Mm. I think the really, really heightened, stylized kind of style, and Clay always does amazing things with animation. They're known for having beautiful art, beautiful animation, really, really awesome stylized sort of graphics. I think that worked for me in terms of making the story go down a little bit easier, perhaps. There is still an uneasiness, and I do think some of that, and maybe I gave it a little too much of a pass for being like, oh, this game is almost 10 years old at this point, you know, being like, okay, whatever, this was so long ago, and I just sort of was enjoying the game so much that I almost, you know, and that's maybe my failing a little bit, but I do think it was so pretty, and that sort of cyberpunk ninja style absolutely was so much fun to kind of play in and play with, and it did so many things for the gameplay in terms of its visual design, in terms of its readability, that I was like, it's fun. Mm. We're having a great time. Again, not defending that read necessarily. Well, it might not have been the most in-depth or sensitive read that I had at the time.
Yeah, for me, it's not that, like, you shouldn't make games about ninja.
Right.
It's one of those things where, like, okay, well, what are you doing with this canvas and with this palette? Are you really just, like, going to paint those same four character tropes that exist in many Western versions of ninja stories, where it's like, oh, this is, like, the cynical master, this is, like, the silent protagonist, this is the ancient, like, tattoo artist. Like, there's a degree of familiarity with those things. I mean, we before we started recording, we were talking about how we all grew up in Ninja Turtles, right? Like, I have loved ninjas for as long as I've loved anything. And so, like, it appeals to me in a big way, but there is a degree where it's like, okay, well, where is that line? And I don't think that this crosses that line. I think there's a degree of, like, I think part of it is the swiftness of the game. It doesn't linger, and it isn't, it never feels to me like it is attempting to say something about.
Story is so unimportant.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it feels
I don't remember
there.
Anything. I don't remember. It is there. And I'm not saying that you should, I'm not dismissing readings of it, of its problems. I'm just, I don't remember anything of the story and plot from back then. I skipped all the cutscenes this time. One thing I would say about Clay is that I think, given how thoughtful the studio has been in the past, I would also think they would maybe have a different approach. The arc of how we're talking about how we talk about games, I think there's also an arc to how games are made. You know, that's not me trying to, you know, give them a pass on it either. It's more that, like, this is a studio that, for example, I wrote an article for Giant Bomb Ball Clay in which in Shank 2, they did a patch where they took out a cutscene in which a character made, like, a threat of sexual assault. Right. It's just sort of an offhanded thing, and they just removed it quietly. And I did an interview with them talking about, like, why they took it out. And they were, like, very upfront, you know, and about how they later came to realize that was, like, unnecessary and made people uncomfortable. And so they are a studio that is, like, sensitive to those issues. I guess that's all to say. One, I think it would just be approached differently from a creative standpoint, like, 10 years later. And that also I wasn't paying attention to it, which is, Rob?
I mean, I think I recognize the validity of the critique. Also, though, I relate to this game as sort of, it's a weird thing. The game isn't necessarily, it's playing with tropes of Japanese culture, but also it's playing with the tropes of other media that frequently just use these tropes right and left and established a lot of them as tropes, right? Like, this is a game that in its presentation, in its style, in its tone, is also about not Ninja, the actual, like, historical characters, but Ninja, the fucking fad icon that they became in games throughout, like, the 90s, right? Where, like, suddenly Ninja were in D&D, and they were the best character class ever. In so many video games, you're some different flavor of Ninja. Maybe you're not even a stealthy Ninja. Maybe it's a crazy bullet hell type, you know, combat game. That's still kind of what this game is playing with. And so I end up in a place where I don't have a great answer for that, because on the one hand, it's taking lightly some tropes about another culture. On the other hand, there is so much media, and it is woven into so much of the fabric of a lot of things in games, that is it playing with another culture or is it playing with games culture? I don't know. And I can't prize those apart very easily.
I will say I'm a little firmer on the insanity stuff here, where I'm like, I just wish the final act of this game went a slightly different direction. That stuff, like, bugs me in a much deeper way.
It's basically a plot from that terrible X-Files episode where Jodie Foster was the voice of a tattoo that made Dana Scully lose her mind.
Wow.
Yeah, that was an episode. Jodie Foster.
Pacific Northwest. I think maybe it's all connected. I want to believe.
That's what it was.
I'm going to leave you because I have to go to a meeting, but two things. One, I'm gonna leave you with this thought, which is, I really love the developer's commentary. If you play the remaster that just came out last year, play with the commentary on. There are little icons all throughout the map that you can hit with the shuriken, and it'll just, like, pop up a text thing to read about the way the lighting was developed or the way this combat encounter was put together. And that stuff is super fantastic as someone who's really interested in there being more opportunities for developers to hit to show the way that their work happens, etc. And the second thing I'm going to leave you with is a break. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to hand off hosting duties. I'm going to throw them up in the air, and whichever ninja is quickest can grab it and take over.
You can hit three things at once, though, so.
I'm going to throw six things up then.
Oh!
And then I'm going to throw a smoke bomb, and I'm out.
Whoa! He's gone, everybody!
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
All right, and we're back. One of the things I wanted to get into here is, I think for a lot of us, the stealth genre has increasingly been about Dishonored-style games, things playing around with the 3D, first-person, you know, thief-looking-glass type lineage. And Mark of the Ninja is very, like, obviously, as a 2D, you know, platform stealth game, is obviously very different about that. And for me, I think it also seemed to necessitate some profound changes to the way you tackle the challenge of stealth. And maybe there was a different way this could have been designed, but particularly what I'm thinking of is Mark of the Ninja unfolds basically as a series of challenge rooms. And now there are specific challenge rooms you go into at various points. You go in to get a collectible where you deal with basically like a puzzle. But I think most of Mark of the Ninja structure is a series of puzzles with different steps. And what ends up becoming my relationship to these spaces, to these puzzles, is there's a recon phase, which is pretty standard, where you're kind of looking around and just seeing where are the guards going, what are their patrol routes, what are the line of sights, what are the lines of sight on various detection items in the room. But once you commit to going through one of these sequences, especially as the game continues, there are not a lot of places to bail out of a run going bad. There are not a lot of recovery locations where you can stop, gather yourself, and reconsider how you're tackling this. And this, to me, I think is a major difference between, say, this and Dishonored, if we're making that our frame of reference. In Dishonored, it sort of follows a pretty standard 3D stealth pattern where you can always run like hell and just get out and escape back to where you came from. There are still specific locations that you sort of need to solve and figure out, but by and large, there's frequently, you're not bounded by the dimensions of this puzzle box they're putting you into. In this, once you kind of commit to that run, it always kind of felt to me like at that point, you basically were a dancer. You had to go through your choreography that you'd sort of put in your head beforehand. And if you blew it, the run was kind of going to collapse. There wasn't a way to sort of put the toothpaste back in the tube. You were either going to just raise hell until you somehow got to the other end of the room, or you're going to die. And those were kind of your options. That's how the game ended up feeling to me, as opposed to other, particularly 3D stealth games. I'm curious how this came across to you and whether you think that's a fair assessment.
I know one way that I was reading Nathan Grayson's original review of this in Rock, Paper, Shotgun from 2012, and the way he sort of put it exactly, not exactly, but I love the metaphor he used. It was, I felt like a bull in a china shop who had to like elegantly dance among the towers of plates, which I think is like the perfect metaphor for how amazing that feels and also how devastating it feels when you don't thread the needle absolutely perfectly.
Yeah, and I really appreciated the fact it's not just novel that it's a 2D game. Like, it leverages that in very specific and interesting ways. And as a player, I enjoyed that because I enjoyed the limited boundary box, the limited possibilities, because it made me, I had a better understanding of all possible scenarios for something to play out in which it's, you know, when you're playing in a Dishonored or a Deus Ex or any of the other 3D games in which like it's constantly, these games are constantly encouraging like often outside factors or random events to sort of intercede on what you're doing as the player. Like, Mario the Ninja is like very strict and very structured, and you only have to go through a scenario fail once or twice, and you sort of have an understanding of like where everything is going to go. And you may not have the elegant solution figured out yet, but you, at least you know what world you're playing in, and what your responses are going to prompt from the other actors who are in this box. And I liked that limiting factor. I liked the fact that each was like a tiny little puzzle that you're poking and prodding and then executing a possible solution on. And the fact that it's a 2D plane, by virtue of it being just left or right, and yes, there's up and down, but there's not much vertical movement to the enemies you're dealing with. It's often you're the one that gets to take advantage of the verticality. I liked the fact that it was this very limited set that you were playing with, because it just gave me a better, the lack of randomness allowed me to often both be more creative and to just sort of enjoy the moment more, because I just knew more of what was actually happening in the scene, as opposed to wondering, well, oftentimes when you play these 3D games like Dishonored or Prey or whatever, well, you could do the same thing twice and shit, the AI might do something different. And that's part of the appeal. And so, like, the reductive nature of Mark the Ninja, this more simplified nature of Mark the Ninja, is something I actually enjoyed, because it was a much more predictable in a way that I think benefited me as the player in terms of like some of the actions I ended up taking.
One of the sort of framings in my mind that I was going into this with was, is this an immersive sim? And we can talk about that later, of course. But if it is, and if it fits on that spectrum at all, it does feel like it's on the extreme left. Or whatever. One side is here. The other side is
the progressive immersive sim.
Right. Yeah, right. Okay. One side. Maybe it's just up and down. I don't know. Whatever. One side of the equation. The other side is Prey, which is probably the most wide open, ridiculous amount of possibilities. Mm-hmm. And right in the middle is Hitman, or the modern Hitman, the modern Hitman's Hitsmen, whatever.
Yeah.
Which has a much more limited set of possibilities, but it is still a 3D space. It does still have many solutions to sort of every type of puzzle. And I really, well, obviously Prey is my favorite, and it always will be, probably. There is an appreciation that I have for this simplified nature. There is an appreciation for this as more of a puzzle game, or maybe a puzzle experience of an immersive sim, than it is a sort of full-blown immersive sim, or fully sort of immersive stealth game, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I think There's a few things happening here. One is that a lot of times in a 3D stealth game, particularly, I think Hitman's a great example to bring in here. Hitman often feels like you think you have made progress on figuring out the puzzle, figuring out how this part works. But what you're actually dealing with, it is a 3D game, and in fact it functions like a Rubik's Cube. The thing you've been staring at for the last 15, 20 minutes reconnoitering, it turns out that once you sort of commit to that solution, you begin to go through that portion of the level that you are certain you've figured out, like, this is my way through. Frequently, you discover that there are other dimensions to this problem that you have not seen. You get through this one place, this one location, and realize suddenly you're looking at things from a different perspective, and you realize that all those things you were doing before to set up this one transit through sequence in the level has completely screwed up what you need to accomplish for this next sequence. I think this happens in other 3D stealth games as well. Dishonored, sometimes you just commit to going across an open space, and it turns out there's something really unforeseen and nasty waiting on the other side that was really tough to see. But in either scenario, you end up in these places where it turns out you just didn't have a clear view of the puzzle, or the puzzle is so freaking complicated. It is so expansive, and there are so many moving pieces that it is just very hard to keep it in your head. You don't...
Well, improvisation, like the surprise is meant to prompt improvisation.
Yes.
And that is part of the gameplay dynamic. Mark the Ninja, there is no improvisation. You flail when you... like, you know, there are moments where it all goes wrong. I've got one guy left, and you can fucking pound on that attack button and, you know, do the clumsy kill. But that's, you know, that's a last gasp sort of effort for a failed sequence. Like, there is no... there's very rarely improvisation. It is all figuring out, well, this section only requires three or four moves. I can see everything in front of me. And then it's just a matter of your fingers doing that and you grappling with the clumsy platforming to do that. But it is very much about a game in which there just aren't surprises. It is not a game about surprising you. It is about, like, that falls in line with the whole meta design ethos of the game, which is clarity and information. And in a game like Hitman and other 3D stealth games, like, there is information in front of you, and you have tools to muster out more, but it often is built on, all right, well, you have this, but then this other factor comes in that forces you to try and do something different. And that just doesn't happen in Mark of the Ninja. And I think that's like, especially both as a contrast, that works really well relative to other games that are playing, you know, with similar design concepts.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that ends up in some ways making it more satisfying as you continue through the game and you start facing more complicated or demanding versions of the same problems. The traps keep getting deadlier. The right. enemies' modes of detection start getting deadlier. They find different ways to put you under the gun without necessarily sticking a big timer on the entire level. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things they do in that vein to encourage you to continue your growth as a ninja. Not only does your character level up and get new abilities, but you also start, this was my arc certainly, the more I played of this game, the more capable I started feeling. Yes, the problems were getting harder. I was having to stop and think a little bit more, but I was also feeling increasingly satisfied by the art of stealth that I was practicing. Particularly those moments where you've timed the guard's pathing and line of sight so perfectly that you are basically threading the needle like time and again between like a laser grid and a guard patrol, and what looks like it could have taken 2-3 minutes of like painstaking moves, you've just like blitzed through it, and that feels really, really cool. And I think that is a nice approach if we're comparing it to the model offered by Prey. If you allow too much improvisation and improvisation without much cost, you end up with a game that can kind of sabotage itself, right? I think where, like, once a game's stealth becomes so completely optional that you can always just kind of throw up your hands and start, like, you know, spamming, you know, just like hammering on the keyboard, and that works the way it works in Prey frequently, it becomes a little harder to have like a satisfying, tense denouement of the game. And I think by and large, Mark of the Ninja maintains that pretty much through to the end, with the exception of, like, I think the last level is very clever, is what I'll say for now, as being kind of a break from it. I like that it doesn't just end with a cutscene. I like that you basically have your last real stealth mission and then the game ends with in a narrative sequence through the lens of gameplay is something I really enjoy. But I think one of the things that ends up being really crucial for this game, and before we start talking about the plot, it's kind of the last thing I want to shout out here. I love how gorgeous the user interface is, and all the little cues letting you know about guard positions and detection zones. I think this is just, in addition to it being a gorgeous looking game, there is something really kind of mesmerizing and subtle and satisfying about the ripples. This is a game of ripples, right? It is a game of footfalls sort of washing across the screen, heavy footfalls causing these giant rings to arc outward that can catch
the way, like, the birds will make a little flutters as they go away. Like a lesser game, the birds wouldn't do anything, right? They wouldn't. They would just be, environmental art that is there as a flourish. And in this game, it's like, not key, but it is one of like many things that makes noise. And it's not just that they fly away, it's that they make their own little sound pattern. Yeah. And like it's a very small touch in a game that is defined by a lot of small touches adding up into a greater whole.
Yeah. I think the one of the reasons this sort of puzzle box design works so well is because everything is so clearly marked and so clean. But also it manages to do that without taking anything away from a really gorgeous 2D art style that feels like a cross between a comic book and, 19th century like Japanese art, right? Is kind of how it feels. And I like the way, as you go through the game, the styles sort of transition as you go from sort of the more glass and steel aesthetic of the Hessian Corporation into the sort of secret headquarter areas of the clan to the final confrontations. We should talk a little bit about the arc of this story. We alluded to it in a previous question. The issue of insanity and appropriation being aspects of the story. I think it's weird, Patrick. You know, I agree to a degree. The story is kind of throwaway. This is a game that's about like playing the stealth game. At the same time, it does have a pretty not super involved, but the way
elaborate cutscenes, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, it's not like a game that is like I was dismissing it largely because I'm playing it a second time. I'm just focused on the mechanics. But you know, yeah, like these are high quality. Like people spend a lot of time building these cutscenes. Like it is a game that is considered the story it is telling. It is not maybe if it's not necessarily hugely material to the moment to moment gameplay, and it's not intertwined necessarily there one to one, but it's definitely not immaterial. Like it's not been ill-considered. Like thought has been put into a story that is being tied between these cutscenes, especially between stages.
Yeah. Danielle?
Yeah, I was going to say, I recall at the time, again, just knowing Chris Dahlin a little bit, sort of from the, indie game scene in Boston at the time, which is where I live, just knowing him a little bit, I remember it being kind of a big deal. I remember people talking a little bit about the story at the time and talking really about sort of the craft of narrative design in games, in indie games especially. This is around the time of that sort of the second wave, I suppose, of like indie explosions of Xbox Live being a thing at all, really, 2010, mm-hmm. 2011, 2012, and people kind of starting to talk about AAA indies in any real sense, which was a whole thing at the time. It was interesting, and of course, I was intoxicated by this idea at the time of like, oh my God, good, interesting grown-up stories and games that aren't just about shooting each other. It's not just cutscenes in a shooter, that sort of thing. So I went into this thinking like, am I going to really enjoy this story? Am I going to really get a lot out of it? And I, like I said earlier, it just kind of didn't really hit for me, and I didn't pay that much attention to it outside of the fact that I thought the gameplay itself did a good enough job communicating like the feeling of being a ninja, the feeling of being powerful, of being quiet, of being very hyper competent, able to thread those needles. Mm-hmm. I felt like that did enough for the sort of general narrative than necessarily the sort of explicit cutscenes, which were beautiful, but yeah, didn't necessarily do that much for me.
Yeah, it tells a basic story, but I think it ends up telling it pretty well by the end. I think something that is complicating here for me is that I think a lot of the characterization exists in the scrolls collectibles and not in the cutscenes. And I think this is maybe where the game runs into a little bit of a problem with making its narrative clear. It took me a really long time to realize that pretty much like most of the scrolls you were collecting were specifically Master Azai's musings on his own history and record. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that, do you really know what Master Azai sounds like? After a point, do you remember that that's the dude's voice? Because like, at first it seems like these might just be collectibles. These are just random, like, you know, ninja-themed knickknacks you find on levels. Here's a death haiku. It's like, cool, whatever.
Knickknacks, yeah.
But what you're finding actually is a lot of the motivation for the major characters in the story. So what starts out as a pretty bog standard story between the cynical, evil techno megacorp attacking the band of traditionalist ninjas for, I don't know, some MacGuffin, turns into a story about, you know, I think students and teachers really ends up being the major theme of the story. your character, the mark of the ninja, is that in the opening, at the end of the opening tutorial, you're given these tattoos that supposedly imbue you with, you know, magical ninja powers, but also drive you mad, and therefore you have to commit seppuku at the end of whatever your mission is in order to protect your clan from your deepening madness. And this is where, you know, we started to run into some of those problems. Mm-hmm. But obviously what you unveil after you've basically dealt with the entire megacorp and you've dealt with the best thing they can throw at you, is the fact that your master Zai was basically using you as a hitman, I guess, mm-hmm. is the way I would put it. That to a degree, this was less about protecting the clan than it was, giving the clan a monopoly on ninja tech IP is the way the entire thing feels. And that is a standard enough pivot in a story like this. But one of the things that worked for me is through this game, you uncover a lot of the memoirs of Master Zai, and he does go from being this completely two-dimensional character of, you thought he was good, but actually he's bad. We've seen a million of those. But it turns into a slightly more nuanced portrayal of Master Zai becomes the model of somebody who feels the old ways are no longer answers to the dilemmas of modernity, and has basically adopted a knowingly cynical, if you can't beat them, join them type approach. And what comes through a lot of those scrolls and memoirs you find from him is kind of this air of like regret and sadness that I think ends up serving the game pretty well and serves the characterization and the tension between these characters really well. But you wouldn't necessarily get that from the cutscenes.
Yeah, shocking. I think maybe this is like, you know, so illustrative of going back to a game like this from that period. I mean, certainly games are still struggling with this like very problem of like hiding, like not just subtext, but like the most interesting things it has to say about its characters within pieces that have nothing to do with the relevant gameplay portions or even like grand cutscenes that players are exposed to. But like this is very much of an era where, you know, this, you know, the era of the original BioShock, in which like this was the trendy way to do these things. But even Mark of the Ninja does an especially poor job, at least in, you know, a game like BioShock, like you are explicitly told, oh, you're going to get interesting story through these collectibles that you find that reward, you know, exploring the space and more deeply considering the environment you're in. And Mark of the Ninja, like, I played this game a bunch the first time, and now I'm playing this game a second time, and I still forgot that there was actual story. I was just picking them up, going to the option menu, like, clicking back, like, stop talking to me, buddy. Like, I got the upgrade icon. Like, we're good. And then moving on to the next thing. It's just illustrative of a game not understand, like, trying to do something. Like, you understand the design philosophy of, like, oh, cool, like, we'll tie the upgrade tree to exploring the space. And, like, the spaces aren't that big, so the players are, like, almost guaranteed to come across any of these things. If they're doing any sort of exploring of, like, extra, like, you know, vents they can go into. And then we're also going to, like, we're going to blow their minds with, like, an extra understanding of, like a more deeper piece of storytelling that's happening. But, yeah, like, it doesn't actually communicate more. It's not clearer about, like, you should be paying attention to this. It does come across as, yeah, just like ninja haikus that are just, you can kind of throw away and move on with your life, which is too bad. Because the fact that I had that attitude even a second time sort of underscores the failing of them to communicate even what those things are from the get-go.
This is also an era where it was like such a divide between sort of the subtle storytelling cues and like the cutscenes. It's like there are two worlds here. Here are the cutscenes, and here are the collectibles that have a little bit of flavor text, maybe, that is just, you know, some writer got to have a field day one day. They had a lot of coffee and they really just had so much fun writing a ton of incidental dialogue or a ton of incidental stuff, as opposed to I'm not saying this is a solved problem, but more sophisticated games now do feel a little bit like there's a little bit more interplay between those two sort of modes of storytelling, of explicit storytelling. I'm not even talking about like narrative through gameplay, but more there was environmental storytelling and then there was the cutscene. And this, yeah, this feels of a piece with that era in some ways, which is not necessarily a failing. It's just, hey, maybe some games have figured out a little bit more subtlety in that direction.
Well, I do feel like I know that moment you're talking about where I think there was kind of a, in the same way that like in film, there can be a prejudice against using voiceover.
Yeah.
Or even it's a visual medium. Really, you should be able to tell your story without dialogue at all, which I think is an asinine, like, you know, I will beat you to death with Billy Wilder scripts if it comes to
different
that.
Stories require different things. That's
well,
the,
right.
Yeah.
But I think in this era, and I'm not sure necessarily that this would have like been something on Nels Anderson's mind or Chris Dolan's mind. But I think in this era, there was a little bit of this snobbishness about narrative through gameplay, like you alluded to, trying to sort of cut down on the amount of storytelling that is being wrapped up in cutscenes or expository lore dumps midway through the game, trying to weave that a little more organically into the story. I think the result is something that Mark of the Ninja is a game that I don't fully know where the story lives. It's a weird thing. It feels really sure. disjointed. The characterization is happening in these scrolls you find. The plot beats are advancing through these cutscenes, which often feel, I don't know, just they feel detached from the gameplay. Like the sheer number of times where a cutscene would end and a new level would start, and I would feel like I missed something. Like, nothing but the end of that cutscene suggests the space I find myself in now. Like, there were all these little discontinuities in the game that I think end up making what would have been a simple and effective story feel weirdly disjointed and distant, and in the end, more disposable than I think it necessarily meant to be. And so I think it does end up falling even flatter when the end of the story is starting to culminate on these, do you choose your master who made these compromises to secure the future of the clan? Do you choose your potentially imaginary friend / symptom of the toxins and madness being given to you by the tattoo? Is the madness real at all? This is a thing, again, important things that come through the scrolls. You find things from Master Dosan, who's sort of the old-timey ninja, who, like, that's totally his vibe, right? He's, oh, ninjas, I remember you guys. That's kind of his character. And he's the one who sort of reveals that Master Izai is up to no good and has been lying to the clan. But one of the things that he hints at in a cutscene, but then I think you find a scroll from him late in the game, is talking about this entire idea of the sacrificial champion. Basically arguing that from the moment the clan started using these kids, and they were kids specifically, the clan started using promising students to basically become these champions who would kill themselves at the end of their mission.
Yeah.
And the idea was that did it like the teachers were forbidden from using the marks, and it became the job of the students because the students were controllable and it also made them dangerous. And I think that like this is a cool tension that the game could have explored, right? This idea of teachers, mentors fearing their mentees. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I think a lot of us who've had like mentoring relationships have had that moment where you start to suspect what I want to do with my abilities is diverging from the vision you have for them.
Yeah.
And that can be a really tense and fraught thing. And I think this game alludes to that. And I think explicitly, like, there's a metaphor here for how eventually, you know, not only do students outgrow their masters, but the way that masters and teachers can sometimes like have that little air of like fear and distrust and resentment toward their students and seek to control them past when they should. I think that's in this game. But none of it quite meshes because ultimately it's a series of ninja puzzle boxes with a story loosely, you know, tying them all together. So I end up in a weird place with the narrative of this game because I like what's there. I think it's decently executed. But Danielle, I do agree. It feels like it's a piece of it's of a piece with its time. I also think this is a very Clay approach to narrative. I think Invisible Ink again has a similar. We got a loose narrative. Here's a premise, and a campaign flows from that. But it's a strange thing. They're very good at thematic enhancements for their games. Narrative does not seem like a focus of that studio, even when they're making linear narrative games.
That's kind of double down on sense, right? Like, I mean, Don't Starve is thematic trappings in which you paint your own story based on, you know, the you know, what happens as you try not to starve.
How long you don't starve, yeah.
I forget the name of that other one that they, you know, launched last year.
Oxygen Not Included.
One that we thought had a...
I think.
Yeah, Oxygen Not Included, yeah. Which is, you know, riffing in the same direction. You know, I mean, that's... They clearly have design strengths in that arena. And in some ways, maybe have recognized that, hey, what if we just lean into the direction that's working for us and abandon the thing that seems like we're kind of just plastering it on top and... it's not working as well, which is too bad because I think, you know, I never played Invisible Ink, but I was desperate for, if not a sequel to Mark of the Ninja, then something that was playing in the same ideas and went in some different direction because it just seemed like there was so much more they could have done with it. But, you know, that studio has gone in some, I mean, Don't Starve basically changed the future of that studio in ways that are less interesting to me because I don't like those types of games, but clearly has made them some money.
Yeah. Probably good if you want like a stable gig making games.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm not gonna and people that like Don't Starve seem to really like Don't Starve, so I'm not gonna knock them for that. Should we jump into the questions that we got?
Yeah. Pat, you want to read this this email from Bryce?
Yes. Bryce writes, I find myself often playing great games several years after the release. I don't have the bandwidth to play everything, and it's much more cost-effective to wait for sales and price drops. Mark the Ninja is a game that I played for the first time in 2018. I found that it felt really dated and simplistic, and my experience didn't match what I read in reviews. So my question is, how should someone like me figure out the right time to play a game like Mark the Ninja? Games don't all age equally well, and I have not been very successful with judging which games I need to prioritize and which ones will still be amazing if I get them 5+ years later. For context, XCOM is another game from 2012 that I only started playing recently, and I found it held up very well. Thanks. I think this podcast has us arguing that Mark the Ninja holds up in some ways, even if it has aged sort of appropriately in the direction that a lot of especially genre games tend to, as those genres are expounded and refined and shifted up. Strategy is certainly one of those, although arguably not much has happened, like post-XCOM. Like, there's been more XCOM, but it's mostly XCOM dominating that style of game. Mutant Year Zero is, you know, playing in that similar space, but it's mostly a lot of XCOM, post-XCOM. I don't know. I don't know if there's, like, I have, like, a very... Like, 5+ years is a long time, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just so much changes in games. 5+ years is enough time for major... games that are seismic shifts to then ripple in to other games, both big and small. And so I think at the 5 year, I mean, 5 years maybe is the mark, right? Like maybe 5 years is like long enough for AAA to catch up. And it's certainly long enough for very small to medium sized games to begin running away with design ideas. I don't know that I can't think of many games that have picked up the mantle of Mark of the Ninja specifically. Nothing is immediately coming to mind, but like in a broader sense, like 5 years is probably a decent like checkpoint of like, all right, if I'm playing a game 5 years later, there's a good chance I've played things since that are going to make this tougher to jump back into. I'm not sure what all y'all, if you think 5 years is maybe an appropriate marker.
Yeah, it depends on the case. I mean, for this, I think you hit on something really important here, Patrick, that there have not been a ton of 2D stealth games of this nature.
Yeah, or even something that took Mark the Ninja and applied it to a 3D space. You know, I'm just trying to...
Not a ton. I'm sure there are some games that have taken some of these sort of approaches, but not a ton. This still feels relatively unique in certain ways, which is, I appreciate it, and I think helped it age maybe more gracefully than some games that are like, oh yeah, there have been 27 of these in the last 5 years, and each one is
it hasn't aged because no one's done anything else with it largely, right? So it's like it hasn't been refined because it is still the thing that it was when it came out.
Exactly. I do think it's sort of also a framing thing and a hype thing, and that is just a pitfall of this world of games, that you know, you will hear so many things and you will hear so much criticism, and you'll hear the sort of the first wave, the second wave, the third wave, the seventh wave by the time, you know, you're playing something. In this case, I think the fact that it's been 7 years has actually helped me appreciate this game. I think if I played it 3 years after it came out, I would have had maybe a less exciting or a less satisfying experience. I think sometimes even a little more time can be helpful because it's like, oh yeah, I heard about this a while ago, but I've forgotten half of the things I had heard about, and I'm going in almost relatively fresh again at this point. But it so depends. And it's also, of course, a question, it sounds like, of cost and of money and time and all those other things that are always really complicated, in which case I know we've advocated a few times here for things like the Xbox One Games Pass and a couple of other ways that are like, oh, this is a relatively inexpensive way of at least playing some of the games that are kind of coming out these days. But of course, there was nothing like that in 2012. So we'll see how helpful that is.
Yeah, it's tough. I think the fact that this game hasn't really been replicated elsewhere, it doesn't feel out of date. At the same time, it's always a tough thing. What do you play right now? What is going to be enjoyable? I think a lot of us end up in a position of, not only is there a lot to choose from that is current and new that people are talking about, but also there is a lot of fraught guilt associated with games piling up on our virtual shelves that we haven't played. And so I think there's a broader question here about how the question of what should I play right now has become so incredibly complicated in a way it didn't used to be. But I think this is a case of, this game holds up if only because, and I think it's the case that this is the only reason, but it holds up because there is no game that has gone to school on Mark of the Ninja and surpassed it and supplanted it, which is something that you encounter with a lot of other influential games, where the early editions or the early attempts become the prototypes for more accessible, more enjoyable games that came out later. That didn't really happen in this case. So if 2D stealth puzzles sound cool to you, this is kind of the game. This is it. Danielle, you want to read this last email from Magnus?
Yes. I love this actually quite a bit. Or Hytal Magnus? Hytal Magnus. Okay, cool. Hey, I was playing... That's how it starts. It starts with a hey. So, hey, I was playing New Super Mario Bros. U earlier this week, and after collecting one of the star coins, I died. As you might expect, the coin didn't stay collected when a fresh Mario spawned. Makes a certain sense, but in Mark of the Ninja, most everything is recorded at the exact moment you achieve it. Doesn't matter if you return to the last checkpoint or even quit to the main menu on the spot. Incidentally, these games both originally released in 2012. A lot of games go one way or the other with collectibles and achievements, so I'm curious. What are your thoughts on this ancillary design difference? Do you have a preference? I personally lean towards Mark of the Ninja, though I acknowledge that it's circumstantial and likely won't suit every game. My thought is that if I've conclusively proven myself capable of doing the thing, being asked to repeat it feels arbitrary. Love the site. Thanks for everything you do. I agree. I prefer, in general, when things sort of stay collected, even though that's corny and cheesy in some instances. I know Celeste, for example, you had to get the collectible. I forget. Was it strawberries? I think it was strawberries. Yes, but you had to get the strawberry and then finish the level. You couldn't just, you know, sort of like, all right, I got the strawberry on that run, and now I'll finish the level on the other run. So, like, there are very distinct areas or distinct games and distinct design paradigms where it makes sense.
I think
sense.
You could quit the level, though, and it would keep it.
Oh, really? There was a way around it?
I think that would
okay,
be
cool.
true.
All right.
It's been a minute since I played that.
Yeah, that was like 10 years ago because 2018 was 10 years long, of course. But I do like that when it's like, all right, you did the thing, buddy. Checked off. Now focus on something else. Because of the way that sometimes extra achievements don't always feel completely inherent to having the best gameplay experience. And in those cases, I'm always going to be like, yeah, just give me the checkbox. I don't care. But in the cases where it is, like this collectible is in such a place or this thing that you have to do is designed to actually show you another way of playing the game or a cooler path or show you a specific skill. In those cases, I'm fine with it being really inherent to sort of finishing the objective.
Yeah, no, I'm on a team Mark of the Ninja. Once you got that thing, that's the thing. I mean, it's deeply irritating. I've been in plenty of scenarios in games where I was then pushed off from ever collecting another collectible again, specifically because so I did the hard thing and then I made just an innocent mistake that like leads me to die before the next checkpoint finishes the stage. Now I got to go back and do that again. Like, nah, like, that's just not going to happen. And I think the notion of being, it's not even being forgiving. It's recognizing the achievement was earned. And, you know, I mean, there certainly can be scenarios in which having players juggle that stuff can create a certain amount of tension. But I'm very much in the camp of if you've done it once, you've done it. Because especially with things that are optional, putting additional friction in layers between the player and doing this optional bit is going to encourage the bad habit, you know, the bad habit from a designer perspective, which is it's just to skip it. Like, right. Why, if I'm not being rewarded for doing the thing, you know, yeah. So I'm very much, it took me a while to realize that the game was doing this because most games don't do this. Most games ask you to complete the objective over and over again, despite dying. And I really enjoy the fact that Mark the Ninja was like sort of exceedingly progressive in that sense. And then it's just like, hey, man, cool. You're good. Like, move on.
Yeah, this game will break in funny ways, though, due to this. Like, I definitely got through some sequences where, Patrick, to borrow your phrase, the achievement was not earned. The progress was not actual. Like, I literally had a run, like, somewhere in Hessian Tower, there was one of those many rooms with, like, a heavy security vault door, one of those motion sensors, and a guard, and another guard on the other side of the vaulted of the vault door, and a planter. And a whole bunch of things went wrong. There was a lot of shooting, a lot of killing people, a lot of being shot. And I died basically as I just dove toward the planter on the other side of this door into the next room. And I respawned hidden in that planter. And
good. Hey, you know,
no alarm raised. You know, all the guards were still alive. And like, I think I might have gotten credit for like a clean run through that room, basically, even though
one of the sub objectives.
Yeah,
good.
it was great. So definitely that broke down in some interesting ways. We just got high sign from our producer. Was there something else?
Just as an aside on that, like, because you get a bonus, you know, if you hide someone in an event or in a sort of like a trash bin. And like, so one of my favorites would be like in those sequences where the easiest thing to do was to put a guy in the trash bin, take his ass out, put the next guy in the trash bin, take his ass out, put the next guy in the trash bin. All right, three guards are in there. And I get the bonuses for all of them, but then there's just this stack of dead bodies next to the trash bin. It's like, whatever, give me my 1,000 points.
Logic.
Thank you. Moving on.
Yeah. All right, so that concludes this episode of Waypoint 101. Sorry for the abrupt ending, but it sounds like we're being evicted from the recording booth very soon.
Control room.
So we need to go. We'll pick out another game to cover very soon. We'll give you a heads up. It sounds like the Kingdom Hearts thing keeps getting thrown around the chat. We may not be able to avoid it.
No, I will go. I will straight up confirm that it's not a 101, but Natalie and I are going to record a series of Kingdom Hearts focused podcasts that will function, you know, in a 101 ethos sort of way, where we are going to play the new Kingdom Hearts. We're gonna take it seriously. This is not going to be snarky. I'm going to drop the shtick. We're gonna play Kingdom Hearts, and I believe that Austin, who is not going to play Kingdom Hearts, is going to be our host and guide to the average person who is confused about what's happening. So I think we're gonna do at least a series of those for the first couple of weeks after that game comes out. We're supposed to get code ahead of the game's release, so hopefully we'll be able to drop something as soon as that game
magical dream drop. Yes.
All right. Until we meet again, Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Klubik.
Danielle.
At Danielle R.I.
And you can find me at Rob Zachney on Twitter.com. Follow all that we do at waypoint.vice.com. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint or on facebook.com/waypointvice. Be sure to join us again for our next podcast. Until then, for Patrick, for Danielle, this is Rob Zachney, vanishing in a puff of smoke.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It's a good teaser. The movie is whatever. I didn't even see the last one, even though Ghostbusters was like
my absolute fave.
Yeah, too. Well,
it was up there for me.
Teenage Ninja Turtles and Ghostbusters. Yeah,
those are the two.
So the problem was not the problem. Same. I came in slightly late to Ghostbusters, so like the toy cycle was coming down a little bit, whereas the Turtles toy cycle
was spinning up.
Yeah. I was very into Ghostbusters, but. Oh my god, when my friend got the fucking trap.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Trap was good.
I had the trap, I had the firehouse.
Oh, I had the firehouse.
I had three different like backpack style things.
Did you have the goops?
Had the goops
that you could make cool shapes out of.
I was 100% all the way in. And then I went on to Turtles, but I think I love Turtles, but in my mind, I never had as many Turtles toys as I did Ghostbusters. Like, Ghostbusters had its claws in me.
Yeah.
I was probably the opposite on that one.
Yeah.
I had almost every Turtle.
I had every Turtle, and then I had, a couple of bad guys, but for Ghostbusters.
Oh, I mean of all of the
Extended
everything. Universe Turtles.
I didn't get all the way in. I loved it. I watched it nonstop. Yeah. I watched all the movies. I watched the musical.
For a couple of years of my life, I didn't leave the house without dressing as a turtle.
There is a video. It exists. So I was very into the musical as well. The Coming Out of Our Shells.
That's it.
Which I never got to see live. Still bumps me out. But I had that cassette tape that played and the VHS tape they put out later of the filmed version of it. And there is a video of me and my brother, my brother trying, but me singing, coming out of our shelves and running around the room. It's on a tape in my closet. I just need to get it digitized. And I've been meaning to get that on YouTube.
Yeah.
To do that. Anyway, we should probably record this podcast because you're going to have to leave.
Let's do it.
I have to bounce in 30, so.